So my job is to relate all the great experience we've heard about to the global, where there is some great experience to share, but also a lot of despair, sad to say. So conflicts to disclose. And here's a brief overview. So what are the issues that we're dealing with? Extent of drug use and drug-linked HIV, and what scientifically sound responses should be. In reality, we have too little evidence-based responses globally, too much repression, which leads to poor health outcomes and human rights violations. The big lessons learned is that good policy practice of a few countries provide really good empirical evidence of on improved outcomes. And our recommendations overall are, is that best practice, state of the art, and what it would take for all of us to get there. And I won't talk about the U.S., but we very much are speaking to the U.S. as well, as we're struggling with the global policy issues. So if you look at some data from the UN, 250 million people use drugs regularly, 16 million of them inject. And very few have access to humane health and social services. Now, HIV transmission, which is injection-linked, is far more rapid than through sexual transmission. And this is some data from Eastern Europe, where I come from. And when you see the yellow line is persons infected through heterosexual sex. Men who have sex with men is the turquoise one, and then take a look at injecting drug user. Injecting drug users driven epidemics are extremely, extremely explosive. And other than Eastern Europe, these are some other examples. As you see, the lines are very steep. Once the HIV epidemic is introduced into a community, it moves with a speed that is actually quite troubling. And here you have Odessa in Ukraine, you have Ho Chi Minh City, you have Manipur, Burma, Bangkok, Edinburgh. So those numbers are quite universal. Now, if you look at five countries with what we call mega epidemics, you will see that in Russia, 83% of people who are HIV positive are infected through injecting drug use. In China, almost 40. In Ukraine, 60, Vietnam, 44, and Malaysia, 70. And in most of those countries, but not only in those countries, and those of you living in the United States will know very well that in most countries, national response to drugs equals policing. So if we look at the legacy of 100 years of the war on drugs, what we know, again, looking at UN data, is that drugs are more plentiful and cheaper than ever before. Violence, corruption, organized crime associated with trafficking. Your neighbors here in Mexico can certainly tell the story. Mass incarceration, policing, which contributes to marginalization and unsafe practices, abuses of human rights and due process, abusive interrogation of people, in withdrawal very often, which really constitutes torture, scientifically sound, right-based treatment inaccessible to many, and actually quite abusive treatment is very often a standard. So these are the coca eradication efforts in Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia. And as you will see, when less cocaine is produced in one country, the other one makes up for it very quickly. So if you look overall at availability of cocaine, you will see that it's pretty steady. So whether we like it or not, this is where we are today. And I think pretending that we can get rid of drug use is somewhat naive. And if we were to show this for heroin, which moved from Burma to Afghanistan, we'll see a very similar story. And on top of that, if we add all of the methamphetamines and everything else that is being produced chemically, I think the market for drugs is really incredibly saturated and impressive. So what happens as a result of those very, very punitive drug policies globally? This is a story from Russia, where people are very often treated in locked facilities. In December of 2006, 46 women who voluntarily came for drug treatment burned to death. because they were locked. And once the fire erupted, there was no one to help them. This is an example that we often see across Asia, China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Malaysia. These are people who are supposedly in drug treatment. This is how their governments consider treatment. People work for 14 to 16 hours, are not allowed to go to the bathroom, are not allowed to go to eat, and this is what their governments consider treatment. I live in Poland, and we don't have those pictures from Poland, but when I look at therapeutic communities and many of their interventions, I would argue that they do not resemble treatment, that they in fact very much resemble abuse. So it doesn't have to be this way. If one looks at HIV infections diagnosed in drug users, take a look at countries that have managed to keep HIV under control. Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Netherlands, Switzerland, United Kingdom, all of them, once recognizing that HIV spreads through injecting drug users community, responded very quickly. Sadly, we do not see United States on this chart. As many of you know, HIV infection among injecting drug users continues to be a very significant problem here. So I think what is really clear by looking at the world globally is that we cannot end AIDS without ending the war on drugs. And why? Very recently, there's a report that came out, which I encourage you to take a look at, the war on drugs and HIV, how the criminalization of drug use fuels the global epidemic. And basically what you will see there is that fear of arrest drives people underground, away from HIV services and into very risky environments. Restrictions on provision of sterile syringes increases syringe sharing. Restrictions on OST and other evidence-based treatment avoidable HIV risk behavior. High-risk conditions and no services in prisons, obviously a story that is very present in the United States. Disruption of antiretroviral treatment, elevated viral load, HIV transmission, and increased drug resistance. And public funds are basically wasted on ineffective drug wars, diverted from proven life-saving services. So HIV has led to revisiting drug policy, and some countries, especially in Europe, adopt sort of multi-pillar policies. And that includes supply reduction, obviously, which is interdiction and policing, demand reduction, which is treatment, prevention of new use, education and prevention, and then harm reduction, protection from HIV and other harms without insisting on abstinence. And I think the trick here is to make sure that these are equitable pillars, because I think for most countries, if you take a look at, with exception of some of your European ones, you will have the four pillars. It's just that for most part, it's three pillars and a toothpick. So I think that balance is what's really important. And I think if we look at the United States drug policy this year when the White House came out with the new policy, we all looked to see how does that translate into a real budget. So again, we have pillars and a toothpick. So I think what's really important is to find the balance. So Australia is an interesting example, which has managed to find this balance. 30 million needles distributed every year in Australia. And what they've calculated is that this prevented 32,000 cases of HIV infection and 100,000 cases of hep C. And for every dollar spent on a needle exchange, $4 were saved. Important bit of info in time of austerity and everyone measuring, really keeping track of the costs. Now, methadone. Methadone is an interesting story, partially because we have studied it up and down. I don't think that there's any other medicine that has been studied so intensely. And I think, I'll come back to Talia's comment. So taking into account that drug dependence is a chronic and relapsing disease, what are the objectives of methadone? To replace heroin use, to improve health status, to reduce illegal activity, to facilitate social inclusion, chances for employment, for example, to improve chances for opiate abstinence. And I want to repeat this because this is not a silver bullet. which is to basically get people, basically assure that people get off drugs, I think it's really important to think about it as improved chances for opiate abstinence. Now, documented outcomes, lower crime rates, lower HIV incidence rates, lower mortality rates, better social integration, cost effective. So if you look at WHO study on OST in 2008, take a look at number of countries: China, Ukraine, Indonesia, Thailand, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, Iran, Australia. It shows that there is 70% treatment retention after 6 months. Any of you who work in drug treatment know that this is quite an amazing outcome. So rates of heroin use by duration of methadone treatment. Again, take a look. The longest and, the best result after 25 months of treatment. And I think this is a key piece of information to think about when you are a drug treatment provider. It's not about 12 months and you're out. It's not about 16 months and you're out. It's basically about recognizing that it's a chronic relapsing disease. So you need to assist people in treatment to stay on in treatment for as long as they want and as long as they need. And it's always somewhat stunning to me when I listen to stories of people who are on blood pressure medicine forever, indefinitely, who are outraged that a methadone patient is on treatment for 36 months. If we think of dependence as a relapsing long-term disease, then what are the justifications for cutting treatment? So impact of OST on crime, in addition to all the health outcomes, is actually also quite impressive. Here's the sad story. The countries that I listed before, China, Russia, Ukraine, Vietnam, Malaysia, where HIV is driven by injecting drug use, take a look how many of those people have access to methadone. Those little tiny blue bars, even though all the evidence in the world is there. Let me move on to this complicated slide, since this is a public health forum. What's really important about preventing HIV among drug users is not just that we have one needle exchange program and one methadone program, and that we offer antiretroviral therapies maybe to some people. It's about taking all of that up very significantly to scale. This is what we've learned country by country by country. And this is a modeling which shows that if you provide substitution treatment, needle exchange program, and antiretroviral treatment at high scale, you in fact can reduce new infection rates quite significantly. Down by 63%. So when we think about triple therapy, we used to think about the antiretrovirals in a public health context. Our triple therapy are those three interventions at very high scale, and it's important to keep that in mind. Now, impact of drug policies on drug use linked HIV epidemics. Again, we know what works, and take a look at those countries. UK, Switzerland, Germany, Australia. This is how they've managed to keep HIV very, very low. And then this is the United States, Portugal, Malaysia, and France, where interventions began late. And here is Thailand and Russia, where we're still waiting for them to actually act. So we often hear questions, so what are good drug policies? And why are we so excited about some of the European states? And it's actually hard, and I think as people who do sort of hard science will tell you, that coming up with indicators per country, thinking about the sort of cultural differences and so on is quite difficult. We actually have managed to put together those three case studies, Portugal, Switzerland, and Czech Republic, three very, very different countries. The first one, Portugal, very Catholic, actually relatively poor, that has managed to decriminalize personal possession for all illicit substances. All of them, not just cannabis, heroin and cocaine included. And what they've done, and it's interesting because people felt like, well, if cops are not going to chase you, you're not going to go into treatment. completely not true. In fact, as the numbers of people that were chased by the police went down, access to treatment and availability of treatment went up, and more and more and more people each year go into treatment. Switzerland. Who thinks about Switzerland as a progressive country? Usually we think about it as very conservative, very economically savvy place. First country in Europe to roll out relatively large scale heroin maintenance program. And when I have a conversation with their police, again, with their police, not their public health people, they will tell me this is great. Because, you know, the 3,000 people that we have on heroin were the ones that were the biggest problem on the streets. They were the ones that were inspiring all of the heroin trafficking into Switzerland. Now that they're in treatment, we don't have heroin trafficking problem in the country. Basically, public health has done my job. Their job, policing job. Now, Czech Republic, just like Poland, post-communist country, and very aware of the sort of freedoms of their citizens. They liked the idea that the Dutch introduced, separating the markets, keeping young people away from the gangsters. Because if you buy cannabis from the gangster, he will also offer you heroin and whatever else. So they say if you want to grow five plants of cannabis in your house, that's your business. Just don't go into the illicit drug market industry. So my time is running out. Let me just make the last couple of conclusions. Well, I think basically what I'm talking about is, I think, no news, right? We all know it, that very, very coercive drug policies are not helping public health. I think the trouble that we've been having and that what we've been struggling with is because it's said by the quote-unquote NGOs, the academics, people don't listen to it as seriously as they could. So there is a now Global Commission on Drug Policy that came together 2 years ago, which has some high-altitude people who are now relating those messages. One of them, for example, is George Shultz, Kofi Annan. So it's not about civil society making the case. It's now about much more senior policy people making the same case. Now, you might have heard that during the UN General Assembly, only a few months ago, presidents of Colombia, Mexico, and Guatemala basically said, enough, let's rethink this. Let's have the UN open the door to actually useful conversation about international drug policies. As you can guess, United States is going to be a very important piece of that discussion, because U.S. Very much inspired the current global drug policy regime. So in conclusion, drug war impedes most effective HIV responses, causes violence and many other harms. Experience of some countries shows that existing public health tools plus less repressive policies lead to better control, HIV control, less human rights abuses. This may be the key moment in growing global movement for rights-centered and public health-friendly drug policy, and AIDS will not be ended unless the war on drugs is ended. Thank you. Thank you.